Welcome to Story Share, a podcast from interviewgirl.com that brings you inspiring stories and advice each week. Today is an episode from interviewgirl.com's World War II Stories series. Today's story is about a veteran who fought on the island of Iwo Jima. Admiral Chester W. Nimitz said, "Among the men who fought on Iwo Jima, uncommon valor was a common virtue." Mr. Al Gallo left his family home on Crescent Street in Astoria, New York, just before the start of spring in 1943 for induction into the Army. His mother, Concetta, and his father, Frank, both Italian immigrants, made him promise to write as often as he could to let them know that he was safe. Gallo, one of eight children, would serve as a radar operator in an anti-aircraft outfit on Iwo Jima, scene of the most famous photograph from the war, the flag raising on Mount Suribachi. When Interview Girl interviewed Mr. Gallo, he was close to 90 years old, and he lived with his wife, Angela, in Garden City South. They have four children and seven grandchildren. His ship left Hawaii on January the 21st, 1945, for their combat mission. They stopped for short periods on Eniwetok, Kwajalein Islands, and Guam. While aboard ship, they wrote letters and assumed that they were dropped off and mailed back to the States from one of the islands they stopped at. No one was sure where they were headed. There was a lot of speculation. Finally, they were told that their destination was Iwo Jima. The captain showed them a map of the island and explained to the men their orders. They were to land on Red Beach 2, which was just below Mount Suribachi. After 35 days aboard ship, they arrived at the island on the afternoon of February the 19th, 1945, which was D-Day. They were prepared to land the next morning. The beach was strewn with wreckage of all types, casualties of the day's fierce fighting. Because of all the wreckage on the beach, they could not land, so they were ordered to remain on the ship. Circling the island just offshore, they could see and hear the ferocious fighting on the island. While listening to the ship-to-shore radio, they learned their flag was flying on Mount Suribachi. They looked up, and sure enough, the flag had been raised and many Marines were walking around. The first group from their battalion landed on D+3. The rest of their battalion, including Mr. Gallo, landed on Sunday, February the 25th, 1945, which was 6 days after the battle began, D+6. They were not able to write letters for at least 2 weeks. There was too much to do. The Gallo family had three sons, all in the war, separated from their family. Letters were their only lifelines. Mr. Gallo told Interview Girl that at one point during action, he remembered watching Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima and seeing American Marines rise to the top. Shortly thereafter, the American flag was raised on the top of Mount Suribachi, where Joe Rosenthal photographed the pictures of the Marines raising the flag. However, Mr. Gallo believed that the flag that he first saw was the first flag that was raised because it was smaller than the flag that Joe Rosenthal photographed, which was a larger flag from another ship. It was weeks after he found out that the photo became famous because there were no newspapers or television while he was on the island of Iwo Jima. When Interview Girl asked Mr. Gallo what the picture meant to him, he started to choke up and said, "It was a historic event and I just happened to be there." The iconic photo symbolized all the sacrifices that Mr. Gallo witnessed and experienced during World War II. He also showed her another picture of him and his buddies looking up at the sky. He said that they were watching B-29s fly over them on their way to Iwo Jima. Mr. Gallo told Interview Girl all about his time on Iwo Island. He described that when he landed on Iwo Jima, they were issued K rations. They were considered emergency rations, which we would use until we were able to get real food. He described that they came in a sealed package that resembled a Cracker Jack box. One of the items in the box was a bar of chocolate that was very thick, very hard, and very bitter. He noted that it would probably be able to sustain them in the event that they were separated from their outfit. No one cared for the chocolate with the exception of Andy Andrews. Andy thought that they tasted pretty good, and he used to eat a good number of them. One night, Andy woke up with excruciating pain. They thought that he may have appendicitis. Mr. Gallo and some of his comrades called their battalion doctor and asked for his advice. He said to take them to the evacuation hospital on the beach. It was the middle of the night and the hospital was a good distance away. Lee Holland, Al Gallo, and a driver drove to the hospital with Andy in an open back of a truck. It was very dark, and they could not use their lights. Also, there was still a lot of shooting going on. As Mr. Gallo described what was happening, Interview Girl thought that a truck moving at night must have made a tempting target, but luckily they made it to the hospital. They left Andy at the hospital and waited around for a little while. They were waiting outside the large tent with a red cross in it that was marked hospital. They noticed sand being kicked up close by. They realized that the Japanese were firing mortars into the area. They decided to leave Andy and went back to their outfit again in the dark. Mr. Gallo then chuckled. Andy finally rejoined us, and I believe all he needed was a good laxative. We told him that all the chocolate was like cement in his stomach. He didn't eat much chocolate after that experience. By March of 1945, Mr. Gallo's outfit was stationed a short distance from the ammunition dump. Many loyal Japanese soldiers, unwilling to surrender, remained hidden in caves and bunkers up in the hills. They would come out of their caves and fire at the Marines or shoot mortars into their area. Mr. Gallo remembered one of those times. It was early evening, just after dark. A few Japanese soldiers had come down from the hills and were firing mortars into the ammunition dump. Mr. Gallo looked over towards the dump and saw a truck on fire after being hit by enemy fire. As the evening wore on, the fire spread across the dump and soon the flames began igniting the shells in the ammunition dump. The shells began exploding all around Mr. Gallo and his comrades. There was nowhere to hide. Not only were they pinned down from the enemy fire, but also the exploding shells that were everywhere. The men had dug in their equipment and tried to protect themselves as much as possible. Many Marines were in foxholes all around them. It was very dangerous for all of them, as shells were exploding very close by, and no one dared make a move to another foxhole. They were somewhat protected, but the gun crews were out in the open and very exposed. Some Marines did leave their foxholes looking for a safer place to hide, and that caused more confusion. Things got even more chaotic when they received reports that enemy soldiers were in the area. There was a lot of shooting that night, and unfortunately, a lot of casualties. To further add to the confusion of that night, they received an air raid alert and every man had to remain with his equipment and be prepared to shoot down enemy planes. Interview Girl could sense the uneasiness of the evening as Mr. Gallo told his story. Some shells that contained tear gas exploded. The men feared that the Japanese were using poison gas. They immediately went for their gas masks and put them on. They reported a poison gas attack and alerted other units. Poison gas was by far their worst fear. Mr. Gallo explained it as, "If you didn't get your mask on in time, the gas would kill you." At the time, we couldn't believe that the Japanese were using poison gas. Even under stressful conditions, sometimes humor can take your mind off the horror for a minute. On this night, when anything could go wrong, a funny incident happened after the report of gas reached us. Instinctively, just like we had been trained to do, each of us reached for our masks and quickly put them on and started to breathe. They looked on in alarm when they noticed that Harry Grover was struggling to breathe. At first, no one knew what was wrong, and their paranoia about the poison gas had them fearing the worst for their comrade. Fear quickly gave way to laughter as they all realized what had happened. When they landed and had to walk through water to reach the beach, they put tape over the air intake valve of their gas masks. After they arrived on land, they were supposed to take off the tape from their masks, but not everyone did. Harry forgot to take the tape off his mask, so he put it on and started breathing. No air was coming in. Mr. Gallo smirked even all these years later. He was in a panic trying to suck air when we realized what his problem was, and I pulled the tape off for him. He said he saw his life pass before his eyes that night. Mr. Gallo survived that night and spent the following days collecting all the shell fragments and unexploded shells that were all over the area. They dug a big hole and were picking up shells and putting them in the hole. One of the shells he picked up exploded when he tossed it into the hole. It was a small shell, but he was hit with many small pieces of metal on his chest and legs. His battalion doctor said that he should be taken to the evacuation hospital on the beach. While there, a doctor had his wounds painted with a solution that he thought could possibly have just been iodine. The doctor marked Mr. Gallo's form, WIA, Wounded in Action. There were two dead Marines lying on stretchers in the same tent. The loss of human life is one of the saddest parts of war. Casualties are difficult to comprehend. As Mr. Gallo told us, as a civilian, he didn't see death in this way, but as a soldier, his view changed. Time and time again, vet after vet said, "War is terrible." Terrible, awful, and words like these were used by person after person to describe war in Interview Girl's World War II Stories Oral History Project. War is, as they say, terrible. The invasion of Iwo Jima resulted in more than its share of servicemen killed in action. Out of 60,000 troops that landed, 23,000 were either killed or wounded, an extremely high rate of casualties. Mr. Gallo described, "As soon as we got to Iwo Jima, the amount of casualties became apparent to us. When we were about to land at Red Beach 2, we could see bodies floating in the water. They were from the landing crafts that did not make it to shore." After he landed, he then saw bodies of enemy soldiers killed by the invading Marines. Mr. Gallo described what they did. "Since we felt we could not leave them in the open, we dug holes, put the bodies on a shelter half, and then buried them. A shelter half is half of a two-man tent that they always carried. The bodies attracted large flies, and the smell of dead bodies stayed with us the whole time we were on Iwo. It is a smell that never left me." He remembered one occasion when he was riding in a jeep. He came across a dead Japanese guy, who he referred to as a Jap, whose body was against the large rock by the side of the road. He elaborated, "It shocked me to realize it was only the top half of a body." Al Gallo elaborated on the Graves Registration Service. Graves Registration began burning the bodies at what became the 5th Marine Cemetery. The anti-aircraft equipment was set up nearby, so Mr. Gallo and his fellow comrades could see them burying the Marines. Mr. Gallo recalled that it was very difficult to watch. Every morning, an empty 2.5-ton truck would go near the fighting to pick up the bodies. It would come back full of bodies, one on top of the other. He noted that because it was a very dangerous trip, they could not spend too much time there. The bodies had to be quickly picked up. "The sight of so many bodies is something you don't easily forget." Mr. Gallo paused, then he concluded, "When I was a civilian, the only dead people I had ever seen were in a funeral parlor." When the trucks returned to the cemetery, the bodies would be removed from the back of the truck one at a time. They would be laid on the ground, and Graves Registration would take one dog tag from each body to notify the family. The body would be completely wrapped in a blanket and then sprayed with an oil solution to keep flies away. A bulldozer dug a deep trench and the bodies were placed alongside each other. They would be covered with the black sand that was on Iwo. Another layer of bodies was put down and covered the same way. "I believe each trench had 3 layers of bodies," Mr. Gallo told me. "It was Grave Registration's job to keep accurate records of where each body was located." He concluded, "When the war was over and we returned the island to Japan, the bodies were removed and buried elsewhere. Many were reburied in Hawaii while others were shipped to their families." We read about the number of casualties during war years after the war ends. Chasing time with Mr. Gallo and being able to hear about how the dead bodies were placed and how they were kept allows us to understand on a deeper level about what it must have been like to see that amount of casualties on the island of Iwo Jima. Albert F. Gallo attended most of the reunions following the war, including the one in Washington in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the invasion of Iwo Jima. The trip was free, and he met with President Clinton, with United States generals who had been generals during the war, politicians, and director Steven Spielberg. The war affected Mr. Gallo, and it took him a while to be able to speak about it with his family. He tried to forget the bad times, like all those times that he had to see dead bodies. He tried to remember only the good times. Mr. Gallo's most enduring memory was the friendships he made with members of his outfit. "I stayed in touch with the guys following the war," Mr. Gallo recounted to Interview Girl. What sticks out from Mr. Gallo's story is that when he and his comrades were given a mission, they did not complain, they simply followed orders. As he put it, "We were trained to do a job, and we did it." Mr. Gallo's story teaches us all to get the job done. Today's Story Share World War II Stories episode was Mr. Al Gallo's story, a veteran from World War II. As always, we will leave you with our question quest. What job do you need to get done in your life? What can you just do? Thank you for being part of another episode of Story Share. the podcast from interviewgirl.com that brings you inspiring stories and advice each week.